Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. Today's episode is inspired by our film, American Craft, What Beer Can Teach Us About Well-Crafted Laws, a documentary short that explores the story behind the craft beer renaissance and the importance of well-crafted legislation. While there's never been a better time to be an imbiber of alcoholic beverages in American history until now, with thousands of breweries across America offering a virtually endless variety of beer, it wasn't always this way. One century ago, a national prohibition was legalized, lasting for 13 years. But what, legally speaking, was prohibition anyway? Here to provide us with a history of America's most sober legal moment is Garrett Peck, author, historian, and tour guide, who has written numerous books on American alcohol consumption, or lack thereof, including Prohibition in Washington, D.C., How Dry We Weren't, The Prohibition Hangover, Alcohol in America from Demon Rum to Cult Cabernet, Capital Beer, A Heady History of Brewing in Washington, D.C., and most recently, a chapter in Prohibition's Greatest Myths, The Distilled Truth About America's Anti-Alcohol Crusade. Welcome to the show, Garrett.
Thanks so much, Samantha. It's great to be here.
So, Garrett, what is American about Prohibition?
Well, the United States is the first country that attempted to ban the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcohol. And by the way, there were several others that followed soon thereafter, but they all repealed it before the United States did. So yeah, it's basically from 1920 to 1933, we banned alcohol production in this country. It's a unique experiment in American history and in world history as well.
I'd like to play an excerpt from American Craft. Take a listen.
Beer's really been evolving throughout America's history.
With the 21st Amendment, one of the things that that was part of the new regulations, federal regulations around alcohol, was to legalize not homebrew, but rather home winemaking. And thus you had a several decades long gap before homebrewing became legal again. So by the 1950s, you've got this rapid consolidation in the brewing industry that leads to just a couple dozen breweries even left in the country by the 1970s.
So our film American Craft is all about the beer homebrewing movement in America. What was the targeted beverage of the Prohibition Crusaders?
Well, all alcoholic beverages were targeted, of course, but what most of the country thought they were targeting was distilled spirits, i.e. whiskey. And so when Prohibition actually goes into effect on January 16th, 1920, many people are rather stunned because they thought they were outlawing whiskey, but they'd still be able to drink beer and light wine. And even President Woodrow Wilson had vetoed the Volstead Act, thinking that it was too extreme. However, the Anti-Saloon League, which was the main organization pushing forward the 18th Amendment, had other ideas, and they effectively took a zero-tolerance policy towards any alcohol above 0.5%.
Why was whiskey seen as so insidious to the American public?
The nation went on this whiskey binge in the 1820s, the likes of which we've never seen before or since. It was just incredible, really. And the key reason for that was that the Ohio River Valley had been opened up, and it was still difficult to get corn to marketplace. So all the farmers, instead of shipping corn, were distilling it into whiskey. And then it would age, get to New Orleans, and go to market. And it's like, hey, this stuff is pretty good. At the same time, Congress had repealed all the taxes on distilled spirits early in the 1800s. Hence, it was super cheap to drink and really cheap to get drunk. And we went on this incredible whiskey binge in the 1820s and 1830s. And hence, the rise then of the temperance movement, which was a legitimate movement trying to make sense and trying to deal with this incredible whiskey binge.
So what was the temperance movement?
The temperance movement was a century-long social reform movement. It really got started in New England, and then after the Civil War, really pushed around the country into the Deep South and the Midwest. And the idea ultimately was to get Americans to abstain from drinking alcohol. So initially, it was about convincing people not to drink at all. That's really the attitude that the Women's Christian Temperance Union took from the 1870s on. And then once the Anti-Saloon League formed in 1893, they decided the way to deal with it was through coercion, by changing the law to force people to stop drinking. And again, these guys had the more a stricter interpretation of temperance, meaning abstinence from alcohol, not just moderating one's drinking, but refraining from it entirely.
By these guys, I'm guessing you mean these women. What role did women play in shaping the legal landscape of American alcohol consumption?
Yeah, and I should say it is women are the huge numbers, but certainly men were part of it as well. The Women's Christian Temperance Union gets organized around 1874 in Ohio. And at its peak, it has hundreds of thousands of women members, predominantly white evangelical Protestants around the country. And their job is to get there into the classrooms and to teach children about the evils of alcohol. And they're also helping shut down saloons in different towns. So it's women who are really trying to rescue their families legitimately, because so many of the men were either drinking themselves to death or drinking up the family paycheck. And so the kids had nothing to eat and so on. And so there was, again, there's legitimacy to this, to this protest movement effectively, because it's kind of wrecking a lot of families to have the men drinking so much. So yeah, women are the big organizers for that. However, you know, by the 1890s, nothing has really changed. And that's when the Anti-Saloon League comes up. So they decide, okay, moral suasion isn't working. We need to change the law. So we're going to use legal coercion to get people to stop drinking.
Who were the anti-temperance crusaders? Were there any women and men organizing to protest these strives for prohibition?
There were certainly lots of men who were protesting and who were anti-temperance advocates, but they never really got well organized, and that was a big problem. I mean, you had, you know, effectively in the country, two major industries and a small industry, the wine industry. So the two big ones were beer and distilled spirits, and those two were constantly at odds with each other. They could never agree on anything. And so there was this existential threat rising up, the temperance movement, and they could never agree on how to deal with it or how to create propaganda against it. So the beer industry, for example, simply decided, well, we're going to call beer a temperance beverage. And of course, the temperance advocates were like, no, 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 it's got alcohol in it. We don't support that. And so, yeah, it's so interesting that the opposition never got their act together until it was too late.
Why do you think that was?
I think, well, a key reason they were sort of surprised at how much, even though they were dealing with the temperance movement, especially since the 1890s, once the ASL came around, but how quickly the tide turned against them once the United States entered World War I in 1917. And you think about this, at the time, the largest ethnic group in the country were German Americans. The German Americans were also the brewers. And who do we declare war against? Germany. So the Anti-Saloon League very quickly, using propaganda, spun beer drinking into treason. And the brewers didn't know what hit them.
So they were totally blindsided by this female temperance movement.
Yeah. Well, the ASL was largely male-driven at this point. Mm-hmm. So again, women did not have the vote yet, not until 1920.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the ASL was almost entirely men.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So how did prohibition impact immigrant communities and immigrant industries in America?
Immigrants were key targets of prohibition. And of course, maybe many of those same groups also realized, you know what, this is targeted at us and we're not going to obey the law. So you had, of course, you know, this huge section of German Americans who had been marginalized because of the war and who were just questioned, gee, are you, just because you're German American, are you therefore seditious? They had their loyalty questioned. And of course, most of them were citizens. But you also had all the Irish and all the Italians in each one of these different immigrant groups. All brought their European groups brought their drinking habits with them. And that's a key thing that the temperance movement was targeting. Because a huge proportion of the recent immigrants were Catholic and a smaller proportion were Jews. And we are at this time, you know, Protestant centric country. And they feel this existential threat to all these Catholics who are coming into the country. And it's like, they drink, we need to get them to stop doing that. So prohibition really is targeted at the Irish, at the Germans, at the Poles, at the Russian Jews, and so on. And of course, you look to the 1920s and look who are the police officers in New York City and Detroit and Chicago. The Irish, you know, go figure, you know.
So how did prohibition impact the everyday lives of Americans beyond, you know, the targeted disruption of immigrant industries and communities?
Yeah, I would say initially, most Americans took kind of a wait and see attitude to see how is this thing going to work. Mm-hmm. But very quickly, skeptics such as H.L. Mencken learned within a couple months that there were bootleggers out there already selling alcohol. And he had actually sold off his automobile so he could use the proceeds to stuff his cellar in his home full of beer and spirits, and quickly discovered that, as he called them, bootitions, bootleggers, were already out there in the market. You know, I mean, it's just Econ 101, you know, very similar thing to the drug wars we've been fighting since the Nixon era. You know, if you try to limit the supply, but there's still demand there, the price is going to go up, and that's going to induce new people to come into the market to try to supply that market.
Based on my rough historical knowledge of drinking at the time, if memory serves me, drinking alcoholic beverages was safer than drinking just tap water or drinking water. What were Americans drinking while Prohibition was in effect?
Yeah. So certainly during the colonial era, that was a big deal to drink like light beers and punches and so on. Because, yeah, as you said, water was not particularly safe. You might have cholera in your water. You had typhoid. You had all these things that might leach into the water from all the different farms. But cities, especially after the Civil War, they all began to get municipal water supplies. And that then became one of the key arguments that the temperance movement made. Like, hey, you don't need to drink whiskey anymore. Now you can have water. Isn't that so much better? Yeah. But by the time of Prohibition itself, actually right before Prohibition, most Americans, if they were drinking alcohol, overwhelmingly, they were drinking beer. That became the national beverage during the Civil War. And that was still, even to this day, still is our national beverage.
Why is beer so popular in America?
Well, thanks to immigrants. First off, you had Scottish and English immigrants who brought ales to us. And then beer really took off in the 1840s when the German immigrants came and they introduced lager. And given how hot our climate is in the summertime, you just think about, if you go to the ballpark, not that any of us have gone to the ballpark recently, given the pandemic, but we will again someday. But you look at all the beers they sell. There's some IPAs, but mostly they sell lagers because it's the summertime friendly beer. It's really acidic. It's good with food. And it's a great, fairly low alcohol sipping beer. And the Germans introduced that and it just took off. People ever since have been crazy about lager beers in this country.
So speaking of beer, why was homebrewing still illegal after Prohibition was repealed?
I think it's simply just one of those things they looked over, the federal government did. And during Prohibition, you were allowed to conserve up to 200 gallons of fruit juice. Of course, that would ferment once you crush the fruit. So it was just sort of expected that farmers could do this. And of course, it was also a carve out for the Italian American immigrants because they tended to make their own wine at home. And so after Prohibition ended, that was already on the books with the Volstead Act. So it was like, okay, you guys can keep doing that. But you know, never was it ever legal to make your own beer. I mean, really not since colonial days. And no one really thought to legalize that again until, of all things, Jimmy Carter, who himself was an abstainer.
So Prohibition legislation focused on thinking about making wine at home, but totally overlooked home brewing.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So is Prohibition viewed as a puritanical law, or would you say it's more of a progressive law in American history?
I think this gets into mythology of our country. We have lots of founding myths in our country, of course. most people today will say like, oh, Prohibition, that was so puritanical. And I will respond, guess what? The Puritans drank alcohol. So it's really not fair to the Puritans to call them that. Really, Prohibition is part of the Progressive Era, which is really 1896 till about 1920, when the Republicans seized control of Congress and the White House that year. And that ends the Progressive Era. So, and tons of progressive legislation gets passed during this time, you know, when we get the vote. And many of these things are great. We get our food protection laws. We ban child labor. So there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of it. And of course, it's kind of the last hurrah of the Progressive Era is Prohibition. So I think we really should view Prohibition as a Progressive Era reform. I mean, they're trying to use the power of the law, the federal government, to improve Americans' lives and to get them to stop drinking alcohol.
Would you say Prohibition is the most powerful exercise of public moral law in American history?
Oh, boy. Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that question before. Certainly it's up there. Yeah. It's let me think that, about that for a second. The anti-saloon league, when they framed the 18th Amendment, they had certain political realities they had to face. They understood that Americans would never allow them to come take away their whiskey or their beer. So they never made it illegal to personally possess alcohol. So the 18th Amendment says the manufacture, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors is hereby prohibited. Not one word about possession, you know. So a lot different from, say, the drug laws of today. So they I think that there was a political understanding that Americans wouldn't accept it otherwise. But at the same time, they were naive, thinking that Americans would simply drink up what they had at home and then just stop drinking. When in fact, the demand was still there, you know. And again, look back to the Econ 101 formula, you know, law, supply and demand, and reduce supply, prices go up, new entrants come into the marketplace.
They misinterpreted or underestimated the American spirit.
Yeah, they really did underestimate the will of Americans to drink. And one of the key reasons for this was World War I. You know, as the 18th Amendment was passed early on after the United States entered the war, and it went on to the states for ratification. And the country ratified the 18th Amendment in 13 months, which is incredibly short. Yeah, amazing. The state that put it over the top was Nebraska, my dad's home state, and that was on January 16th, 1919. This is 2 months after the armistice, ending World War I. So most of the states had ratified the amendment during the war, everyone thinking in terms of, oh yeah, we need to do this to save grain so we can win the war effort against the vaunted German army. No one really thinking in terms of the consequences, like, how are we going to enforce this? And you know, what happens on January 17th, 1920, when Americans wake up and realize, oh, geez, you took our beer away? Is that what you were doing? Are you kidding me? You know? So, yeah, people didn't really think about it, ultimately.
Yeah. How are these temperance advocates able to legislatively maneuver America towards making alcoholic beverage creation and consumption illegal in the entire country?
That is such an interesting little facet of American history. And the key person we look at is Wayne Wheeler, who was the, quote, legislative superintendent of the Anti-Saloon League. Today, of course, we would call him a lobbyist. And he moved to Washington, D.C. in 1916 to oversee the passage of the 18th Amendment through Congress. And he was the one, even back in the 1890s, who formulated the ASL strategy, which was to leverage their base. Their base was the evangelical Protestant ministers across the Northeast, the Midwest, and the South. So, and getting them to leverage not just their congregations, but also the politicians. And so even though the ASL was never a large organization, but they knew how to use pressure politics. And by the way, that phrase, pressure politics, Wayne Wheeler invented that term.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think he's one of the most, if not the most powerful lobbyist in American history. The politicians were scared to death of him because he showed early on when he was in his early 20s, he had told the Ohio governor who was up for re-election saying, you have to support the temperance cause or I'll make sure you're unseated. And wow. When the governor refused to embrace temperance, Wayne Wheeler was good for his word. And so he was very bipartisan. Mm-hmm. He worked with Democrats and Republicans, but he basically required everyone to vote dry, even if they were wet in their personal lives. Again, they were scared to death of him. So, and Wheeler himself died in 1927. So he never, and that took away a huge force behind Prohibition, and he never got to live to see the unwinding of his dream.
Wow. Sounds like the bifurcation of the self in politics.
Yeah.
So why did we need a constitutional amendment for Prohibition and another one to repeal it?
Yeah. The country had tried as 1845 with the Maine law to try to ban alcohol. And a number of states tried as well to ban alcoholic beverages, following Maine's example. And within a couple of years, all the states had repealed them because it just wasn't working. There were so many bootleggers. It was like a precursor to Prohibition. And then all the states realized, okay, they're missing the tax revenue. And there was so much lawbreaking going on because people still wanted to drink, and bootleggers simply showed up and started distilling spirits. And it made the problem worse because there was so much lawbreaking going on. So all the states then repealed their laws within 5 years of the Maine laws as they were passed. So the the temperance movement has realized this error. And so they decide the only way they can really do it is not at the state level, but they have to get it to the federal level. And the way they build this up, of course, is throughout the early 1900s, they get the states one by one to enact dry laws or local option laws, allowing counties and cities to declare themselves to be dry. And then once there are enough counties and cities are dry, the state legislature would then vote to make the state dry. And that would then pressure Congress. So they kind of worked it up that way. But still, the main goal was from the beginning to change the Constitution. Because that was, as they saw, that was the ultimate solution to change the law of the land. And it wasn't just changing the law, but they wanted to change the fundamental law of our nation to ban the alcoholic beverage market. The liquor traffic, as they called it.
If the prohibitionists were so concerned about this missing tax revenue, how did they propose to solve the tax gap here?
Yeah, excise taxes were a hugely important source of income for the federal government all the way up until the prohibition era. And today, it's a very small portion of our federal revenue. The key thing that actually made prohibition possible, because as you said, all the brewers and distillers were like, hey, we pay all these taxes. You need us, federal government. So, you know, you're dependent upon us. We got the, in 1912, we changed the Constitution or amended the Constitution to allow the income tax. And that was a huge game changer. So the progressives were able to use that and say, hey, we've now found a replacement for these alcoholic beverage excise taxes that can now fund the federal government and federal services. And so that was their way, their game going forward.
So when prohibition ended in 1933, was there talk of removing the income tax since they got their alcohol tax back?
There was actually no talk about that, other than from some of the elites, a few of the anti-temperance elites, some of the very rich men who were involved with it. They were talking about, yeah, let's end the income tax. Let's maybe reinstate heavy taxes upon distilled spirits and beer and wine and whatnot. And that it went nowhere, really. The Great Depression was going on. The federal government needed every penny. And so when Franklin Roosevelt comes in 1933, by the end of that year, he's passed effectively a whole new excise tax regime related to alcoholic beverages. And one of the things he did was actually to lower the tax on beer, because he understood that to be the drink of the working man, and then greatly increased taxes on distilled spirits and on wine. And this made up for nearly half of federal revenue at that point, so which is incredible. So you see these excise taxes, largely this is what pays for the New Deal, which is amazing to see it. Yeah. But I mean, the income tax was in the toilet in this era because a quarter of the workforce was unemployed. You know, people just not have the money to make enough money to even pay taxes.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. How did the income tax compare to what they were getting off of the alcohol tax? It doesn't seem like it would be an even trade.
Yeah, at that time, during the Great Depression, absolutely, the excise taxes off of alcohol and tobacco and other things was absolutely crucial to fund the federal government. Today, of course, it's a nit in the overall. Yeah.
How does the story of prohibition impact America today?
That's a good question. And most Americans today, I think, tend to look back on it romantically, which I don't encourage. I'm an historian. I'm fascinated by prohibition. And in many ways, I think prohibition is the gift that keeps on giving, because there's not a month that goes by that someone doesn't ask me to give a lecture about prohibition. And I'm happy to do that. But if you remember back from the first decade of the 20th century, when all these fake speakeasies started opening up. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. And there
were so many in New York City that people started calling them speakeasies because they were kind of gimmicky. And the bartenders had these funny, quirky mustaches, and they'd wear their vests and funny suspenders, et cetera. And you're like, okay, this is really a shtick, you know?
Now we call them hipsters.
Yeah, exactly. And I think most of the bars have moved beyond that point. But yeah, people tend to romanticize the past, which I think is dangerous. We all kind of look at, oh yeah, bootleggers, et cetera. Wow. I don't view them as freedom fighters. They're not some, libertarians out there striking a blow for personal freedom, as some people tried to position it as. I mean, these were felons. They were breaking the law of the land and making an illegal product and then selling it entirely tax-free. So, I mean, the amount of law breaking was just astonishing during the Prohibition era, you know? So again, I don't romanticize it. I think it's absolutely a fascinating era, and how was this thing ever going to work? But, you know, let's not romanticize history, folks.
No more nostalgia.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, lots of things we enter, you know, mythology in our country, and we can sort of put on the rose-colored glasses when we do that. But like lawbreaking, you know, I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think we glaze over the violence, destruction, and terrible things that came about during Prohibition.
Yeah, the gangland warfare that was going on. I mean, very famously, the St. Valentine's Day massacre, where Al Capone's gang took out another gang, an Irish gang, you know, because they were fighting over turf. You had, I think, in 1926, where the federal government actually literally poisoned alcohol and killed a couple hundred people. You know,
really?
Yeah, and Wayne Wheeler was like, ooh, and one of his worst PR moments, he was like, well, they shouldn't have been drinking. And it was like, oh, no, you didn't. You know, sort of, you know, the federal government should not be poisoning its citizens. You know,
and well, so, that's a first that I've heard.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And within a couple of months, the federal government backtracked on this.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing.
So speaking of mythology, what is your favorite myth regarding Prohibition, including your myth number 9 from the chapter of the book that you just contributed to?
I don't have the book open here with me right now if you want to recall it for me. So, but my favorite myth that I love to break apart is the big myth of Joe Kennedy being a bootlegger. That myth is not true. He was not a bootlegger. He certainly was wealthy already. And what many of the wealthy people got to do was to stock up on alcohol before Prohibition started. And he had a big cellar at his house in Massachusetts. And so he simply could just load up. The wealthy really got away with a lot because they didn't ever have to engage with the bootlegger themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had staff who could do that for them. So they didn't really have to take any risks. Whereas the working class people who Prohibition was largely targeted at, you know, if they went out and bought a drink, they were liable to get caught and go to jail, pay fines, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, Joe Kennedy was never a bootlegger. He certainly did short the stock market, and that's how he made his first fortune. The second fortune, of course, was he went to Hollywood and became a Hollywood producer. But yeah, no bootlegging in Joe Kennedy's history. But that's one of these big myths, and I hear that one all the time. As often as I hear that DC was built on a swamp, and that's also another myth because DC never had a swamp.
Really?
Yeah. It's. I mean, people think like somehow this humidity just comes out of the ground or something when it's actually the jet stream coming up from the Gulf of Mexico.
I literally lived here for like almost 10 years and I just assumed I was living in a swamp having come from Florida, which is actually a swamp.
Yeah. It's funny. These things take hold and you know, they become facts to so many people. Like, oh yes, of course. You know, George Washington never told a lie, et cetera. Of course he told lies, you know?
Yeah.
But
so what are some of the remaining regulatory barriers left statewide and federally after Prohibition?
So all the states, because of the 21st Amendment, gave them the power to regulate alcohol within their borders. And that was part of the political agreement behind the 21st Amendment. So every state had to come up with its own regulatory regime. So you saw all these different states and DC, thanks to Congress passing its law, DC had no home rule at the time. And to regulate alcohol. And many of those are still in the books. That they've been modified a great deal, especially over the last 10 to 15 years as consumers rise up and say, you know what, this isn't working for us anymore. But it certainly worked fairly well for, you know, 3/4 of a century. And over time, consumers rebel and say, hey, you know, we want things changed. We want to be able to, for example, to get a pint of beer at a brew pub. And laws had to be changed to allow that to happen. There were many blue laws passed at the time. And what blue laws are, these were effectively laws for the Sabbatarians, those people who wanted to enforce businesses to be closed on Sundays. In fact, I'm in the process right now of moving to Santa Fe. And I was out there recently looking for a place to live. And my mom and I were planning dinner. And we went shopping at about 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. And this recipe I was going to make called for a half a cup of wine to go into it. And I bought a bottle of wine, brought it up there to the checkout counter. And the woman says, you can't buy that till noon, and simply pulls it out. I'm like, what? I mean, but this is the laws going back to 1934, which basically it was kind of a sap given away to the Sabbatarians. who didn't want anyone buying alcohol on a Sunday. And then they, you know, modified it to say basically, oh, okay, no one can buy alcohol until after church is over, you know, essentially. And it's like, that's not still not freedom. You know, I had to go back to the supermarket a little bit later on that same day just to buy the bottle of wine. It's stupid, you know, but these are, and this is why consumers rebel and call their legislators and say, you know what, can we modify this, please? And, you know, hence you see the chipping away over time of many of these 1934 era laws.
Absolutely arbitrary. So back to your myth, I've uncovered your myth number 9, which is prohibition changed little about American drinking habits. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. Prohibition changed American drinking habits quite a bit. Before prohibition started, as I mentioned earlier, Americans were overwhelmingly drinking beer. However, during prohibition, what the bootleggers were producing and selling to everyone was distilled spirits, for the simple reason is that it's so concentrated and therefore more profitable, because you can cut that with water and make so much more money. I mean, imagine a barrel of whiskey versus a barrel of beer. You can make exponentially more money off that barrel of whiskey than you can the beer. So the economic incentive was there for the bootleggers to produce distilled spirits. And that's how Americans fundamentally changed their drinking habits during this time. It is so interesting. This is a really keen anecdote, but once prohibition ends, one of the, probably the leading leading brewer in Washington, D.C. is Christian Heyrich. And I read it in his journal in 1934, once he reopened, he was like, what happened to the beer market? People don't want my beer anymore. They had so fundamentally changed their drinking habits during this time. And of course, it's also the Great Depression. A lot of people didn't have the money to go out and even buy a beer anymore. So, but yeah, prohibition fundamentally altered American drinking habits. And you think about like even the wine industry, because even though wine was illegal, but there were all these little caveats. For example, you could, you know, make 200 gallons a year of preserved fruit, which would of course turn it into wine. There was companies like Vineglow, which would sell you these bricks of raisins. And they would, there was even a serviceman to come by your house. And the package, by the way, had the instructions. It would say on there, do not place into a container, add sugar and water, or otherwise a fermented beverage will result. I mean, those are the instructions, how you do it, you know? And of course, you're using raisins and putting sugar in it, and it's producing really sweet wine. Well, that gave Americans this really taste for sweet beverages. And we didn't recover from that really till the 1970s, when American wines finally started becoming more dry. But, you know, if anyone's had a bottle of Manischewitz, I mean, no offense to Manischewitz people, but I'm sorry, I just can't. It's so sugary.
So why do you think America's flipped? Because by the time, you know, craft brews started up again in the 70s, I guess the wine industry was swinging back, but mostly in the 50s and 60s, the wine industry in America was pretty much a joke.
Yeah, it really, really was. Yeah. And prohibition had virtually killed the wine industry. I mean, it took until the 60s before it even began to recover, which is really astonishing. Yeah. And so Americans largely were drinking whiskey during this time. You know, that's, and then of course you also had the national beverage of beer had really taken down an awful lot. I mean, it was consolidating very rapidly during this time into just a couple of national producers. So yeah, wine took a long time to start to recover. And you look at the three beverages and, you know, wine is definitely number three as far as consumption.
So would you say even today, prohibition inspired the rise of the American cocktail?
Well, the American cocktail it really started in 1806. That's where we see the word cocktail first used in print. And of course, cocktails were a big deal all throughout the 19th century. And you have cocktails invented during Prohibition, many of which take place, some in the United States, but many others in overseas, like Harry's Bar in Paris, France. And yeah, so the cocktail has constantly been evolving over time. And then, of course, you saw this huge falling off of cocktails as whiskey became unpopular as the Greatest Generation started to wane. And the baby boom rose up and they were like, we don't want anything with the name old in it. Like Old Forester, Old Granddad, or, you know, any of those. They were like, yeah, we're a young generation. We don't want anything that's going to remind us that we're going to get old someday. So they started drinking vodka instead. So yeah. So you really saw vodka really rise up in the 1970s. And then whiskey's resurgence, really, that started happening again in the 2000s. So it's, again, it's fairly recent that, you know, with a really a 30-year gap there, that the bourbon industry nearly died in the 1970s in the U.S., which is incredible. If you ever drive through the Kentucky countryside, it's just amazing. There are these old, dilapidated and beautiful old factories just boarded up everywhere, all across the bourbon country. You know, these country, all these companies just went out of business. Amazing.
So what or who is or are behind some of the contemporary efforts to overturn prohibition era laws in America today?
There's a number of groups. There, for example, Free the Grapes, which has been really pushing to make, you know, wine clubs able, and for wineries to be able to ship wine out to people nationwide. And largely, they've been successful. I mean, one by one, the states are lowering their laws. In fact, the majority of states, vast majority of states now, allow people to ship wine to in their borders. And that's a big deal, considering so many people go on vacation. If you might go to Napa or, you know, I mean, every state at this point has a wine industry. Every single state, including Alaska. Yeah. So, you know, yeah.
Are they making ice so wine in Alaska?
Yeah. Good point. They're definitely making ice, yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of organizations like that. So you have both consumer organizations and then, of course, trade organizations. And Free the Grapes, for example, they represent the wineries. That's their main constituency. But they're trying to open up the market so that consumers have the opportunity to get what they want. You also have restaurants who want, you know, more liberalism, the ability to get to buy for the consumers to be able to buy a drink from them. And you saw that a few years ago, for example, in Utah, which still has some of the most stringent laws around alcohol. In 1934, when they created their state laws around alcohol, they are an absolute control state. So you can't buy anything retail-wise unless it's from a state store. And on top of that, if you went into a Utah restaurant or bar, they had what was called the Zion's Curtain. So meaning literally there was a barrier between you and the bartender, and you were not allowed to interact with the bartender or see what they were doing.
How mystical.
I mean, as if... Yeah. I mean, as if the bartender was a crack dealer or something, you know. And Utah is heavily reliant on tourism. And at some point, the state legislature realized, okay, we're looking kind of foolish. And, you know, there's all these crap breweries that have opened up around Utah and even distilleries like High West. And so eventually people saw the light and were like, okay, well, they liberalized that somewhat now. So you can actually talk to a bartender and do other things now in Utah. So, but it took, you know, the restaurants and consumers to kind of speak up to the legislatures to get them to change the state laws.
Have there been any added or repealed alcohol laws and regulations amid or after COVID?
Oh, that's a good question. I think one of the things that, which I found to be a nice little thing, which states, not every single state, but some states allow this, which is the drink to go.
Yeah, that's
and this
all
was
over
really
DC.
Just yeah, and it really helps out the restaurants. You know, there so many restaurants have survived because of food to go. You know, you get on the app, you order your food, and they also allow you to order a drink, and then you can take that to go. I mean, beforehand, the cities that allowed drinks to go, you can number on one hand. I mean, I can think of New Orleans and Las Vegas. You know, you had to have a plastic cup, but you could take it with you. And this proved to be a lifesaver to so many restaurants around the nation. Of course, not in New Mexico. I asked when I was there just a couple weeks ago, like, hey, we are getting food to go. Can I order a drink? And they're like, only if you want to get a felony. So I'm like, nope, I don't. So
I remember during like towards the end of the pandemic, when it was still in full force, the histrionic, as it seemed, alcohol laws, at least in DC, where I swear one week I could go to happy hour, get a drink with my roommate and no food and be on my merry way. And then a day later, I tried to do the same thing and they forced me to order a food item because the governor kept changing the laws. So I was just very curious about how we've, you know, American drinking freedom has increased or decreased or both post pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, I would say overall things probably liberalized a little bit, although for about a year, we really couldn't do a happy hour, or at least it wasn't really safe to, you know, until we got our shots and stuff. So I've gone to a few happy hours, but every single one of them has been outdoors. And I've got, at this moment, I've had one of two Moderna shots. The other one coming up shortly. I'm excited about that. So the other concerning thing, of course, is that American consumption went up quite a bit during the pandemic. And in my book, The Prohibition Hangover, my very first book, that came out in 2009. And there was still a great deal of debate back then that alcohol might be healthy for you. And there's still a little bit of that's out there. I still wonder about the French paradox. Is that, actually, could it potentially be healthy for your heart and so on? But largely, we've seen over the last decade a lot of research coming out just showing you the harms of drinking alcohol. And I'm a drinker, by the way. I'm not a heavy drinker, but, I like to have my daily beer. And
if you weren't a drinker, I'd be shocked and untrustworthy of all of your information.
But readily acknowledging, among men, especially, it causes colon cancer. Among women, breast cancer. If you're a heavy drinker, it can cause huge heart issues. It really can damage your body to drink it, which is the importance of drinking moderately.
What would you say we can learn about the American spirit as evidenced by the history of prohibition?
I think quite a number of things, but the fact that Americans in some ways were like, wait a second, you took away a fundamental right from us, this right to drink alcohol. And when a lot of people thought they were simply just banning one aspect of that, whiskey. So and Americans decided they were not going to obey that law. And fairly quickly, certainly by the mid-1920s, so many people had a relationship with the bootlegger or they were bootlegging themselves. So that was one of these key things that undermined the law, that Americans just were not going to obey this constitutional amendment. It's one of those few things. I mean, generally, I think of Americans as being law-abiding citizens, But when it came to prohibition, so many people decided, nope, I'm not going to do that.
Why should lawyers and law students care about the history of prohibition?
Prohibition is such an interesting case study. And of course, many of the laws that come about from prohibition are still on the books. So as we continue societally to negotiate the role of alcohol in our country and in our states, so it's going to keep being continued discussing, I believe, for decades to come. It's like many of those things. We negotiate constantly over these things about what is the status of alcohol, who can drink, when can we drink, and so on. So, or are these laws outdated? And that's something we're certainly have been butting our heads against over the last couple decades as Americans want more liberalism in our drinking habits and in our ability to acquire alcohol, whether it's from happy hour or being able to buy a drink on Sundays from a liquor store.
Yeah. I recall we released a video a few years ago on the Supreme Court case, Tennessee Wine and Spirits Retailers Association versus Thomas. So I imagine there are many more Supreme Court cases to come.
Quite possibly, yeah. I think the biggest one, of course, was the Granholm versus Heald back in 2005, and that opened up states to importing wine, and it made a strong argument for state regulation, but that the states had to be even-handed about it. And after that, you started to see a lot of the laws starting to be changed, as I think a lot of people started questioning, why are we making this so difficult for business to operate? And yeah, for the moment, I live in Virginia, which was once, and still is, dominated by Protestants. But beforehand, the Baptists had such a strong influence over alcohol and alcohol policy, and they didn't want anyone drinking at all. And then, come the 2000s, and suddenly the state really changes tack. And suddenly it's like, oh, wait, all these craft breweries want to open up. It's good for tourism. It's good for taxes. It's good for jobs. And suddenly Virginia is just like, liberalizing all the laws and we have all kinds of local craft breweries now. It's amazing. The state has really been opening the gates here for these small businesses to operate, because it's ultimately good for the bottom line for the states and good for communities.
Absolutely. Do you have any other closing comments about American craft or prohibition?
Yeah, let's not do that one again.
No more prohibition.
And I certainly think we need to take another look at the drug wars, which has been going on since I was a little kid, the Nixon administration. And are we winning them? No, we're not. I mean, it's not a war you can win. We have drug habits and we've been treating it like a law enforcement issue, when in fact, I think we need to treat it as for what it is, which is a national health crisis.
Yeah. So prohibit prohibition. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good slogan.
So thank you, Garrett, for joining us today for another episode of our FedSoc Films podcast.
Thank you so much, Samantha. It was really fun being here.
So our guest today was Garrett Peck, author of many books on prohibition, and most recently, Debunked Myth Number 9 in Prohibition's Greatest Myths, The Distilled Truth About America's Anti-Alcohol Crusade. You can check out our film, American Craft, What Beer Can Teach Us About Well-Crafted Laws, on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.